funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There was a time when the word BlackBerry was synonymous with smartphone. BlackBerries, of course, were those full QWERTY keyboard little wonders revered by business power players for their security, durability, and functionality. Today, pulling out a BlackBerry in an important meeting might be a liability, or at the very least, a signal that you have not kept up with developments in technology. So what happened between the 2 months and the mid-2000s when BlackBerry rushed to fill orders for a million devices, and today when the former hardware giant is limping along with less than 1% share of the overall smartphone market? The iPhone happened, of course, but as my guest has learned in a detailed investigation of BlackBerry's fall from grace, the company was also a victim of its founder's failure to anticipate and effectively respond to a rapidly shifting cultural and technological landscape. Sean Silkoff is a business writer for The Globe and Mail and co-author, along with Jackie McNish, of the new book Losing the Signal, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. Sean, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Reading this book, I was reminded of Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath ideas. BlackBerry was such the undisputed giant of the smartphone sector that it didn't seem possible it could be felled overnight.
And yet a downfall is what happened. It's quite something. I was in a crowd of people the other day, and I asked, you know, put up your hands, those of you who have a smartphone. And of course, these days, you don't even think twice. Everyone puts up their hand. And I said, do you know how many people would have put up their hands if I'd asked that question 13 years ago? Nobody. This has been one of the most rapidly adopted technologies, consumer technologies, that we've seen, certainly since the television. And it's an incredible story because it starts with a tiny company above a bagel store in the outpost of Waterloo, Ontario, about 20 years ago.
How did you convince so many of the key players, by the way, to talk to you for a project that, after all, would chronicle success followed by, like, devastating failure?
I think part of it was that the timing was right. This was one of the great mysteries of the business world. What exactly happened to this company that was really on top of the world and forged essentially a new way of communicating? Nobody really knew. This was a company that suddenly seemed to be awash in troubles. The two longtime CEOs, Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, stepped down. The world's business press were really chasing after this story. As luck would have it, after a long investigation, we were able in September 2013 to publish a big story in our newspaper, The Globe and Mail, up in Canada, about how BlackBerry blew it. And it was really the first in-depth look at what led to the company's downfall. The outpouring that we got from that story was immense. Just about every major business news outlet in the world covered that story, which is quite unusual for a story about a Canadian business. And we realized that there was an awful lot of interest in this story. And it really helped open the doors as well with a lot of people inside the company. I think our attempt to document the story, what happened, convinced a lot of people, including Jim and Mike, that we would give a fairly balanced consideration of what had happened. This company had so many problems, and at the same time, Jim Balsillie was in a very public fight to get a hockey team in the National Hockey League, and Mike Lazaridis was funding major physics institutes up in Canada. So this sort of, we think of it as kind of a lazy narrative that it developed. Oh, people said, well, Jim took his eye off the ball to focus on hockey, and Mike's obviously interested in other things, and they were just caught flat-footed by the iPhone. And we discovered there was a far more nuanced and fascinating story than that. And I think our attempt to tell that in the newspaper really opened up doors with people. And again, as I said, the timing was right. They'd left the company been a couple of years. So that's how they decided to really open up to us.
They're interesting, driven guys, both. What brought them to mobile technology and what brought them together?
Well, it's really a wonderful story. It's a rise and fall of a company, but it's also a rise and fall of a partnership. Mike Lazaridis was the son of immigrants from Turkey to Canada. They settled in Windsor, which was it's across the river from Detroit. So Windsor, a lot of kids who grew up in Windsor end up working in the auto plants. Mike was a boy genius. He made a record player out of Lego, and it actually rotated. He was the kid who you know, he was such a bright and confident young scientist that his teachers would drive him to their homes after school to fix their stereos. He won science fairs. He went to the University of Waterloo, which is actually a world-renowned school for engineering. Before he went, his one of his most influential teachers in school said, you know, the person who marries computers and wireless technology, well, they'll do something special. So he always kind of had that in his mind. He dropped out of Waterloo to start his own company. So he was off there innovating above that bagel store. And along comes Jim Balsillie. He's a kid from, I guess you could say, the wrong side of the tracks. He grew up in a lower middle class home in a small town in Ontario as well. Very, very ambitious and driven. He wanted to go to all the right schools and head to the top of Canadian society. He went to Harvard, but he still had sort of a chip on his shoulder. And, you know, there's a really insightful line. He said when he got to Harvard, he felt like there was 89 Nobel Prize winners in his class and one fraud. And he was the fraud. A guy who tried really hard, threw the best parties. You know, he was looked down upon by some of the more establishment kids he went to school with because he really did try too hard. Took a hard turn away from the typical Harvard track of going to Wall Street because he could see that technology was really going to be his way of making it in the world. You know, he was going to have a harder time not being part of the club like all of his classmates. So that's why he headed back to Waterloo, ended up working at a technology company. And the day these two met, Jim was working for a company trying to squeeze a better deal out of a tiny supplier. That supplier was Research in Motion, which is now BlackBerry. They laid eyes on each other, and they each were left with a different impression. Mike saw in Jim an absolute shark who was very, very savvy in business, a good operator, and someone who had the kind of skills he lacked. Jim saw somebody who, frankly, rolled over a little too easily on business dealing. So not a great entrepreneur, not a great business person, but a brilliant technologist. And both could see in the other an absolute boundless ambition to do something special in the world.
Were they friends in the way that you and I might use that word?
No, and that's one of the most compelling things about their partnership. I mean, these guys were so close in the theater of war of that business is. I mean, they could finish each other's sentences. They had all kinds of signals in meetings. They were really, it's like they shared one mind. But, you know, when they checked out, well, I didn't think they really checked out ever. I mean, when you're an entrepreneur, it's 24/7. But when they left, they really had nothing in common. Mike is a scientist. He, you know, when he goes home, his hobby is his work. He reads scientific journals. He would take home stacks of manuals of products. His world was science. Jim was very athletic. He had a lot of interests outside of business. The two just had really nothing in common except this business.
I'm old enough to remember the time when just a cell phone was a really big deal and it seemed like a miraculous device. How did the concept for smartphones arise and who were the earliest people playing with the idea that they could do more than simply send and receive calls?
Right. You have to go back in time to the 1990s. And at this time, there's a real push by some of the world's most advanced technology companies to put some kind of a mobile communications device in people's hands. So you've got, you know, you might recall IBM with the Simon. You had Apple with the Newton, which was, I think that was the one that Doonesbury made a lot of fun of. The Palm Pilot, the Viking Express from Ericsson, and Nokia had the 9000. So you had all these companies trying to put something, some kind of a tiny computer essentially in people's hands. And, you know, all of these devices were, I mean, the Palm had its moment in the sun, but, you know, there was a combination of the technology wasn't quite right. They were a bit too bulky. You had to use a stylus or there was a tiny keyboard that, you know, only a squirrel could use, like on the Nokia phone. And they didn't, you know, they were expensive. And the networks back then were fairly primitive. We talk about 4G networks now. Everyone's dreaming about 5G. Well, back then it was 2G. And I won't bother you with the science of it, but basically these were fairly rickety networks that had real capacity issues. And if you used one of these products wirelessly, you were looking at major bills. Motorola had a two-way pager. That was yet another product. What BlackBerry, what Research in Motion at the time figured out was you had to put something compelling in people's hands that they actually wanted to use and that was easy and fun to use. but also that kind of respected the limits of the science. So, you know, they didn't try and put everything in people's hands. They tried to put one thing well, and that was email. And this time, you know, email is really taking off. Everyone's sort of inundated with, you know, with stuff in their inbox, especially if you're a traveling executive. You get to your hotel at the end of the day, you log in, and there's 150 emails. Well, you're not going to bed at 9, you're going to bed at 11 after, you know, adding 2 hours to your workday. And they figured out basically it's a fairly complex system, but what was great about it is they took all that away from the user, so it kind of seemed like magic. Your email would just arrive in your hand no matter where you were. If you were in a hotel lobby, if you were in a taxi waiting in line at an airport, and you could deal with 10 emails here and 20 emails there. And and it was fun to use. So they got it into the hands of Wall Street traders and CEOs. I mean, Michael Dell was one of the, not far from where you are, he was one of the very first people to place an order for it. Jack Welch of GE was raving about it to his friends on the golf course. So it really took off. But there were limits to the network that BlackBerry was using. So they knew that they couldn't just do an email device. They would have to move over to the regular wireless carrier networks eventually. And that's what they did. And when they did that, it's almost like they added voice as an afterthought, because a product had to be basically certified to carry voice. So the first smartphone actually had a thing that you plugged in, like a headpiece. It was very awkward, but that was sort of the first smartphone. And then the second, and that was I think in 2002. And then the next iteration, they actually managed to get the voice and the speaker in. So thus was born the smartphone around 2003.
So they made these deals with wireless carriers, but data on BlackBerrys actually could travel on two different systems, right?
Well, that's the genius of the system. They built, and it was based on this old technology they had. It was a network called Mobitex. It was Bell South in the United States, and up in Canada was Rogers, that had these data-only networks. And they were originally serving, you know, like if IBM had service trucks and they wanted to send data messages. So BlackBerry, Research in Motion had worked closely with these two networks to kind of build the computer language and build modems, basically like the on-ramp and the language that they used to really develop this. So they had to – the problem was if you wanted to put a BlackBerry in people's hands that worked on this system – they also had to, you know, as a customer, you also had to get a connection to this network, which is called Mobitex. Well, that meant calling the phone company and waiting for them, and maybe they would do it in a month, maybe they would do it in 2 months. And the whole idea behind the BlackBerry is you wanted to stick something in people's hands and have it fired up in 15 minutes. So they had to build a whole back office network that basically it was quite complicated, but it would take a message from your desktop. It would shoot it over the internet. It would end up at Research in Motion through their computer system. It would relay through their system, get onto the Mobitex network, so that you know you didn't have to get that Mobitex connection. They could use BlackBerry's Mobitex connection, fire it out into the towers, and then send it to your hand. And it looked like an email had just arrived, you know, in your handheld device, like magic.
We're speaking this hour with Sean Silkoff, who is a business writer for The Globe and Mail and co-author of the new book Losing the Signal, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Globe and Mail business writer Sean Silkoff, whose new book is called Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Sean, this proprietary system of data transmission that BlackBerry had the added appeal for business users that it was secure. Can you talk about why that was so important?
Well, absolutely, because, you had chief information officers who really needed to guard the secrets of corporations. And, if you want to sell into the enterprise market, you have to make sure that your technology is not going to compromise the company at all. And they figured out early on that they had to encrypt messages, so they'd be encrypted at the device and when it arrived at the other end. In fact, what's interesting about their approach to the market is they decided it was actually kind of hard to break into this market because a typical chief information officer is very conservative. These guys control massive budgets. And in Fortune 500 companies, we're talking about potentially billions of dollars. They're very conservative. They don't necessarily want to bet on a technology because you never know if a technology is going to change from year to year. And you don't necessarily want to do business with a tiny company because who knows if they'll still be around in a year. So one of the most clever things they did was actually more of a marketing thing. They had this system that you had the BlackBerry and you had this piece of software called the Redirector, and they could sell this directly to CEOs and other executives, and they could plug it into their computer and get their email sent to their device, and it completely went around. It did an end run basically around the systems inside the company, and the idea was if you get a CEO loving their BlackBerry, plugging it in. And they also priced it so it was within the discretionary budgets of a lot of executives. Kind of a really sneaky strategy. And the idea is you get enough people inside a company using this and loving this, people with senior executive responsibilities, that they all start to put pressure on the chief information officer saying, the tech department saying, look, we want you to install a central server inside the firewall so that this can all be managed in one place. And it was a somewhat successful strategy at first, but they actually quickly discovered that no, the CIOs were very conservative and they kind of needed a handholding. So they were able to sell dozens of devices, maybe hundreds, but at a certain point they had to basically recruit experienced people from the business, folks who had worked installing giant Microsoft or Oracle systems, to come in and explain to the CIOs, this won't compromise your security. You can put it behind your firewall. And that's when they started to get the big orders in the thousands of devices.
Let's go to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Corey on the line in Dallas. Hi, Corey.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, Corey.
So, hi. So this is one of my favorite topics. I love this. I talk a lot about BlackBerry, and I want to start with a quote that says, even if you're on the right path, you can still get run over if you quit moving. And I remember several years ago when iPhone was first coming out, BlackBerry had said business users don't need cameras, and they detached business users from having families and having personal lives. So I feel like that was the key moment in BlackBerry's failure when they decided business users didn't need cameras. And I have had smartphones, all of them. But what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that they would have survived if they had started having cameras in their smartphones?
Well, actually, it's interesting. They had just put a camera on the smartphone. There's a device that came out in 2006, just on the eve of the iPhone coming out. It's called the Pearl. And this was really they'd already been sort of pushing into the consumer market for about two, 3 years at this point. This was their first real consumer-centric phone. And you know what? It had a camera. It had a media card. It had a music player. It had kind of all the what would be considered bells and whistles. The thing about BlackBerry that's really interesting is that it's a company that kind of – it sort of had to play by the rules, because before Apple came along, the carriers really – you know, the wireless carriers, the giants like AT&T and Verizon, they really kind of ran the show. And BlackBerry had all kinds of struggles trying to get innovations in. And they also had all these corporate customers, and you know, a lot of them. Remember, some of them were in the government, and they said, you know, we don't want a camera on this phone because we don't want people taking photographs of sensitive documents. So it was really only when they pushed ahead with the Pearl that they actually added a camera. So this was an innovation that they did bring in. I mean, I think in Mike's view, he wasn't necessarily against innovation. His first reaction could be very. He'd often say no, 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 and then he might change his mind. There's a couple of funny anecdotes in the book about that. Somebody says we need a USB port, and he throws them out of his office, and like a day or two later, he comes back and says, "How come we don't have a USB port on this phone?" you get a good sense of him, and his first reaction is often conservative, or he says, "Well, you know, our big corporate clients will never want it." But as they were moving into consumer markets, as their sales were really taking off, they actually did move in that direction. But that sort of comes back to the carriers. I mean, Apple came along, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more this hour, but Apple basically came in and broke all the rules. And what you started was an immense transfer of wealth and power from the carriers to the smartphone makers. And it started with Apple. You know, when Mike and Jim saw the iPhone, I mean, Mike's first reaction, he was puzzled. He didn't understand. And the reason he didn't understand the iPhone was this. You know, RIM had offered the world email, a very parsimonious use of data, respected the scarcity of network space. Okay, it did almost nothing to batteries. The original BlackBerry ran on one AA battery for a month. And the first iPhone ran down a battery in about 4 hours. Typing on glass was not easy. I don't know if you remember Damn You Autocorrect. people had a lot of fun with that, because typing on glass was an art, not a science, and very challenging. And it wasn't as secure as the BlackBerry. And the amazing thing is he was right about all of those things. I mean, AT&T was swamped with data usage as the iPhone took off, and it really led to some terrible service problems. Typing on glass, it wasn't ideal. It wasn't as secure, and you know, the battery problem. People were plugging their phones in all the time, but you know, it didn't matter, because they had reconceived the idea of a smartphone. It was you were now putting an entire computer, the entire internet in people's hands, and it was a beautiful product. And that's what the folks at Research in Motion missed in the outset.
How was AT&T convinced to take the gamble on the iPhone? Because Apple went to other carriers and said, "Can we work a deal? And we want to put all this data and put a computer on these things and have a web browser." And not everybody thought that was a good idea.
No, and it's funny, you know, Steve Jobs was certainly no fan of the carriers initially. He called them the four orifices. He was very dismissive of them. And that's the world that RIM really developed in. You know, you had these big carriers pushing them around. But I think, you know, consolidation was just sort of really taking hold. And you had Bell South. It still wasn't part of AT&T at that point. And I think, you know, Apple had initially done a deal with I think they're working on a music player and a phone with Sprint. Anyway, there's a general sense in the carrier industry that Apple was going to partner with somebody. And I think that sent a chill through the telecom business, because they saw what it had done with the iPod. Apple had created a beautiful little handheld device. And the world wasn't yet sure what they might do with a phone, but you could kind of see some of the directions they were heading in. So basically, this was the mobile data market was taking off. It was into the billions of dollars, and Silicon Valley was not going to let this tiny little company from Waterloo rule the roost. It inevitably drew competitors, and it ended up drawing some of the most fiercely competitive, powerful, and valuable companies in the world into its market.
How did BlackBerry in the mid-90s monitor the competitive landscape? What did it do to sort of know what was coming on the horizon?
Well, they were, they were very plugged into the mobile data market, and they could see what was happening. I mean, they were in with Bell South, and that was a fairly major carrier, and they were competing against huge companies like Motorola. they were well known within the wireless data market. I mean, wireless data was sort of this was kind of the ugly stepchild, of fairy tales, I suppose, at that time, because voice was taking off. Everyone had cell phones, and nobody could really make mobile data work. So the biggest the biggest dog at the time was Motorola, and they were trying to make two-way paging work. But what Research in Motion had was, frankly, they had better technology. They had their radio modems were better than Ericsson's, and they were able to develop two-way communication more effectively than Motorola. They raided – there's a school up near – not too far from Waterloo called McMaster University. They basically cleaned out the radio department of all of its – brightest graduate students, and these folks came in and formed the nucleus of their radio group, and that was significant. They also worked with Intel. They convinced Intel to take an ancient chip, I think it might have been a 186, like an old chip that had kind of had its day, and to sort of strip this down so that it could power mobile devices. So they were able to convince some pretty, they had Bell South and they had Intel. And they're working with Ericsson. So they're very much plugged in with some of the big players in technology that are trying desperately to make this old Mobitex network work, generate some revenues. I mean, they made a major investment in this Mobitex network, and the only company that seemed capable of getting any revenues out of it for them was Research in Motion. So they were able to leverage that relationship and really build on it.
Email was one thing, but did Mobitex only allow BlackBerry users to text message other BlackBerry users?
Well, it's the science gets complicated, but actually they wanted to Bell South wanted to two-way paging. That was their big thing. And Mike kind of looked at two-way paging, and he didn't really see the point in it. I mean, paging was these tiny little canned messages, and he actually tried to convince Bell South initially, well, why not just do all full email? And you know, Motorola had introduced two-way paging. It was hot. Bell South wanted a kind of a B2 Pro follower. So they said, no, it's about two-way paging. And actually, when Research in Motion went public in 1997, that's all they were talking about was two-way paging this, two-way paging that. The two-way paging market will be this large in X years. And at the same time, they're working on developing, using the same two-way paging device, this whole system for sending email. And they believed in email so much that they actually convinced Bell South to sell them network time so that they could run their own email service. If Bell South wasn't going to offer wireless email, RIM was going to build it themselves. And so they actually convinced them, because this thing was making so little money for Bell South and it was at risk of being shut down, that when BlackBerry offered them all of $5 million for airtime, Bell South said yes. I mean, that's how little money this network was making. And then they actually started reselling the time themselves, and it took off. And it wasn't until it took off that Bell South realized what it had done. And BlackBerry had the leverage at that point to get a better deal out of them.
So as elegant and revolutionary as the iPhone was, of course, the first ones weren't perfect. They did have the issue of battery life and, they worked a lot more slowly and it was hard to get data when you were on the road, that sort of thing. But it did become clear that there needed to be some kind of response from BlackBerry. Verizon wanted it yesterday. How did planning get underway for what would become the storm?
Right, and this is really the critical moment when BlackBerry goes from being an innovator and a world beater, a giant killer. I mean, it had felled. If you think about it, it had outsmarted Nokia and Motorola, and it had basically killed off Palm, more or less, or made the Palm Pilot irrelevant. Verizon didn't. AT&T had a 4-year exclusive with the iPhone. Verizon quickly realized that the iPhone had sort of redefined this market, and they came. They came to the leader in the market and said, can you do an iPhone killer for us? And Mike's first response was, well, how about another keyboard phone? And they said, no, we want something with a piece of glass. Mike hated typing on glass, and he thought he had something in the lab that he thought could do Apple do the iPhone one better. And it was a project called the Storm. For your listeners who haven't seen it, you have to imagine a device with a piece of glass, and instead of just sort of lightly tapping on it with your fingers, you depress the entire piece of glass, and it clicks down, and it makes a clicking sound and that sort of tactile feeling. And this, to Mike, was the BlackBerry version of a a touchscreen phone. You know, it clicked. So, you know, you had that. So a virtual keyboard would appear on your screen, and you would click, let's say, where the P is, and the entire screen would click down, and a P would appear. Well, the problem is Verizon wanted this, as you said, in 9 months, a very, very short window. This is new technology for RIM. It needed new software, new hardware. The first prototypes worked really well. Verizon loved them. But when they started producing them en masse, it was an absolute nightmare. The phone was late. It was needed for Thanksgiving 2008, and they just got it in on time. It was buggy. I mean, just about all of the first ones that went out needed to be returned. And by the next spring 2009, Verizon calls Jim Balsillie down for a meeting. We have a scene where he's practicing in their Falcon jet how this meeting is going to go. And what he's not realizing is that, you know, one of the top folks at Verizon down in New Jersey says, well, you know, we want $500 million. We want you to make us whole for this disaster. And, you know, they gave them a different solution, and it didn't work. And what ends up happening is, you know, if Apple puts Research in Motion on the ropes, the knockout blow comes next, because Verizon still doesn't have its iPhone killer. It knows the storm's not going to do it, and they turn to Google. At this point, Google has been struggling, trying to get its Android operating system out. The first phone wasn't really successful. The carriers were kind of a little bit spooked by Google because it had bid on Spectrum. They didn't know if it was going to try to become a phone company. And Motorola is on the ropes as well. It's been put there in part because of Research in Motion and because of changes in the landscape. Motorola throws the Hail Mary pass and says, we're going to go all in on Android. Google agrees with them, and Verizon turns to these two and says, can you make us a smartphone? So the next Thanksgiving, 2009, it's time. The Droid comes out. Within a year, Android was the number one smartphone platform in the world, and you start to see BlackBerry sales really deteriorate in the States.
Sean Silkoff is with us. He's a business writer for The Globe and Mail and co-author of the new book, Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with business writer Sean Silkoff. He works for The Globe and Mail, and he has a new book out called Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Sean, how were Balsillie and Lazaridis affected personally by the stress of having this implosion taking place all around them?
Well, that's one of the startling things about this is getting two people who are very public and frankly a bit guarded in public to open up with us. And there are a couple of things we found out that we didn't realize. Nobody really knew. There was a big patent dispute, you may recall, with a patent troll in the early to mid 1990s, and it led to a trial and a showdown that could have actually led to the shutdown of the BlackBerry system in the United States. The trial was held in the District Court of East Virginia, and it had such a devastating effect on Mike that he basically disappeared for 2 weeks. Intense stress on him. Jim Balsillie then takes over the case. He tried to get the patents that this patent troll firm had quashed. That had actually been originally patents held by another inventor from Chicago who had tried to do innovations in the wireless space himself. And he tried to do everything he could to get this overturned. They hired lots of lobbyists. They brought in the former Prime Minister of Canada to work the hallways in Washington. And they had a very tough judge. And you get to a point where it suddenly realize he starts to realize that he might be running out of options, and really worried about the future of the company hangs in the balance, that they're going to have to pay an enormous financial settlement. And in the fall of 2005, he lost about 20 pounds, and he had to turn to a personal guru. He said something absolutely chilling to us in the book, and that's I never contemplated suicide, but it didn't seem like a bad idea at the time. And it's really rare to get a CEO of a company, and especially someone with such outward confidence as Jim Balsillie, to really open up like that. The other thing that really affected the two of them was there was a stock options backdating issue with the company. There were a lot of technology companies that went through this, but the one that Research in Motion experienced was very damaging. In fact, it basically struck at the heart of their partnership. Mike had always left the business side of things to Jim. Jim had left the science to Mike. In fact, he never went into his lab. And, based on our reporting, Mike felt that Jim had basically let him down by getting the company embroiled in this mess. And Jim felt, this company had nearly died a dozen times. And he felt that, at times in the past where they'd had big problems challenging the company, that they'd sort of stood shoulder to shoulder. And he felt that Mike wasn't there for this. So it really led to a deterioration in the relationship. I mean, they continued to run the company together, but what you start to see develop inside the company is a real dysfunctionality, distrust. One of the senior executives described it as a goat rodeo. And this is happening and tearing the company apart right when they need to be doing basically everything right, if that's even possible, to counter the onset of Apple and Google.
And then on top of everything else, in 2011, BlackBerry suffers this truly disastrous service outage, 3 days.
Yeah, 2011 is just the year when kind of everything went to pot. The company missed, their market share was really deteriorating in the United States, but they were growing like gangbusters around the world, so you hadn't really noticed it in their numbers. 2011 was the year where you started to see a deterioration in their financial numbers. So that the stock went down, you had investors baying at them. They introduced their tablet, the Playbook, and we, there's a we detail in sometimes grisly detail, I would say, in the book, just how ill-conceived and badly executed that whole project was. They ended up writing off $500 million, at the end of the year. And then you have the service outage, and this is supposed to be always on, always connected, I think was their motto. And for 3 days, people around the world couldn't send BlackBerrys, including, of course, the president of the United States, who was a big BlackBerry user. There was other things that happened that year. You had there was a riot in Jakarta. People in Indonesia still wanted BlackBerrys. They were lining up for them, and there was a big promotion, and you had this disastrous riot. And adding to the spectacle, you had two executives got drunk on a plane from Canada overseas, got rowdy. They had to be attached to their chairs with plastic restraints. They tried to chew through the restraints. They had to turn the plane around. I mean, it was like the cherry on top of a really terrible year. And then within weeks, they both decided that they would step down.
And then, but before that, and we'll talk about them stepping down in a moment, they had tried to do some, like, let's turn it around with marketing by partnering with U2, which is ironic in part because people really associate U2 with the deals that they made with Apple for iPod. But talk about what happened there.
You know what? RIM marketed itself to one person, and that one person was Mike Lazaridis. And if you look at their marketing at the time, it's like everybody loves BlackBerry, and it's basically their marketing conceives of a world where everyone lives on their BlackBerry. Everyone loves their BlackBerry. BlackBerry is like an extension of who they are, and that had been the case for a significant subsection of the population, very important people, like 5 years earlier. But in 2009, 2010, 11, when these ads are coming out, it's a whole new world, and some of their advertising was so kind of self-assured. You had these ads. I watched this one ad. I couldn't believe it. It's 30 seconds of Bono and U2 performing on stage, doing one of their songs, not a BlackBerry song, just one of their songs. And at the end, it just says, you see the logo, and it says BlackBerry loves U2. You don't even see a device. It's like they thought they were advertising like they were Coca-Cola, whereas at the time, if anything, they probably should have been telling the world, well, here's what we do well, and look at this feature on this device. I mean, it the attributes of the product were really important to stress at that point. Because the amazing thing is people still love their BlackBerries. Maybe it's a thing up in Canada, but people still like the keyboard. They miss it like they miss an old flame, you know? And they really wish the BlackBerry was it's better now. They're still making devices and they've upgraded the software, but people still wish they didn't have to use an iPhone or an Android instead of a BlackBerry. That seems to be a prevailing view among a lot of people.
So one by one and in different form, Balsillie and Lazaridis sort of limped away from their positions at the top. What finally motivated them to do that?
I just think they saw that, they couldn't lead the company anymore. They were just such a lightning rod. It was time to go. Mike and Jim were both going to stay on the board. They had a handpicked successor in the head of the handset business. But Jim had a whole new strategy. I mean, and this is one of the things that happened in 2011 as well. They had dueling strategies. Mike really believed that the new handset that they were working on was going to the new software was going to save the company and put wind back in their sails. Jim saw that software and instant messaging was the future. He wanted to put a big bet on BBM, the BlackBerry Messenger, which was enormously popular. The other side of the house was worried that, if you made BBM available on Apples and Androids, that it was going to eat into handset sales. It's a true innovator's dilemma. Well, what you see now, of course, is WhatsApp, I think a year ago, sold to Facebook for about $17 billion, instant messaging on mobile devices, which another thing that BlackBerry invented. We also invented mobile instant messaging. They became also-rans in a market they created because their service wasn't available on other phones. We actually give, I think, the first account I've ever seen of how BBM was born. So Jim had the strategy to really try and monetize, make billions of dollars in revenues by kind of embedding this with the carriers. But the other side of the house, his currency was all spent, and the board wasn't willing to back this, and Mike and his successor didn't believe in it. So as soon as the company abandoned the strategy that Jim had really worked very hard on for a year, he said, that's it. He decided to leave the board. As soon as he could, he cut his ties. He sold all of his shares. Mike held on for another year or so to see the BlackBerry 10, their latest device, come out, but he was also concerned about the direction. He was worried that they were going to abandon the keyboard phone, so he went out one day. I think it's the last anecdote in the book. He goes out and he buys a box of keyboard devices because he's worried that BlackBerry will no longer make these.
Was it like a Radio Shack that he walked into? Like the whole thing, it just is. It's poignant in a way
it
that
is.
is funny but also really sad.
Yeah. I think it was a carrier store or a Radio Shack, but. The good news though is these two guys. I mean, technology companies rise and fall, and BlackBerry really changed the way we communicated. I think it, it's been downsizing. The company's still very much a going concern. That there might be a second act for this company. Will it recreate the world the way the world communicates? I don't think so. But they've got a lot of patents that are very valuable. They've got $3 billion in cash, something like that. So they're still, and they've got a very capable manager now in John Chen, who's a turnaround artist from California. So there's we're not writing the eulogy for BlackBerry just yet, but both of these guys, they're out, they're contributing. Mike has poured a significant amount of his fortune into theoretical physics. He may be financing the breakthrough innovations for decades to come. They may even dwarf BlackBerry. Something called quantum computing, which is absolutely fascinating. And Jim is advising startups in the Waterloo region. He's got a couple of think tanks that he finances. He's a leading voice on innovation policy in Canada. And you've got thousands of engineers who left BlackBerry, and they started up their own companies. They've gone to other companies. Many of them have stuck around Waterloo. So it's like a cedar tree falling in the forest, and as it disintegrates, it starts to nourish the rest of the forest. So that's actually kind of a good news story coming out of this as well.
John Chen has played his cards pretty close to the vest thus far. Is there reason to believe he has a viable plan to resurrect the company?
He has a plan. We haven't seen if it will pay off yet. His idea is really, he's you know, he's still putting out new devices. He put out a really cool device called the Passport, which is it's the shape of a passport. It's kind of bulky looking, and the classic phone. And both of those are actually, well, the Passport was something that Mike had in the lab when he left, and the classic is based on an older phone that was very popular, the Bold. So, you know, these guys left a lot of – Jim and Mike left a lot of gas in the tank. His plan is to shift the company more towards software. So he said they're going to double software revenues this year. We'll see. We haven't – you know, he said it'll happen by summer. And then the last time he spoke on a conference call, it was more like, well, maybe in the fall. So we haven't seen the proof yet. It's still a shrinking company. Their handset sales have not turned around yet. When you have half of 1% of the world's smartphone market, they kind of stick you at the back of the store. You're not up at the front with the latest Android and Apple devices. So they have a big challenge on their hands. And but again, I mean, he's got options and he's got assets in that company that are quite valuable. So I certainly wouldn't write BlackBerry off just yet.
What are the lessons here for the people who are leading Apple and Android right now with regard to the dominance that they're enjoying with their devices?
Well, I think anyone in technology, regardless of whether you're Apple or Sybase or Qualcomm or whatever, would say, you know, technology is a brutally competitive and predatory business. If you don't protect yourself, you won't survive. I mean, some shark will like what you have and do their best to drive you into the ground. I think that's one of the lessons from the BlackBerry story. I think people in Apple might laugh if they heard that, but and I certainly wouldn't. it's still the most valuable company in the world. These are very valuable and powerful companies, but I don't think anyone in technology takes anything for granted, because this is innovation, and innovation is about disruption, and this is the world that they were forged in, and I think they all understand that. I think in technology also you have to be prepared to question absolutely everything, including the pillars upon which your greatest successes are built.
What kind of phone do you have?
I have a classic, and it's not because I'm just a BlackBerry junkie. I had a Q10, which was another BlackBerry. My T key stopped working, and so I needed another phone, and I needed one quickly, and I didn't want to have to teach myself a new system, so I said, well, I'll go with the classic. I'm sort of agnostic about smartphones. They don't excite me anymore as long as they do what they're supposed to do. And so far, the classic is doing what it's supposed to do.
Did that grease the wheels of any of your interviews?
No. I mean, we interviewed former BlackBerry people who had Apples and Samsungs. Jim had a playbook still. So I think there's still loyalty to BlackBerry. But no, people understand. The world has moved on.
Sean Silkoff is a business writer for The Globe and Mail and co-author, along with Jackie McNish, of the new book Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. Sean, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And if you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.